Psalm 95 is the third in a series of psalms on the kingship of Yahweh. We've done 93 and 4 already, and I expect this morning to finish off this section, this subsection of the psalms. Psalm 93 celebrated in song God's victory and God's reign, and Psalm 94 God's activity as judge. Now Psalm 95 speaks of the homage that we owe God and the need to respect God's authority as king equals king judge. The psalm's in two parts, as we'll see. In the first part, the psalmist invites us to join in praise of Yahweh, the great king, the creator of the universe. Then comes a warning. Those who were freed from slavery in Egypt, we're reminded, failed to enter the promised land because they failed to heed God's word. And the psalmist says, let not the same happen to us. If we think we can engage in cult, religious cult, without listening to God, we're putting God to the test in failing once again to place our trust in God. We may be entering the physical building of the temple, which is obviously what's happening as this is sung, but we're not entering the promised land, and we're not entering true rest, and we could once again lose what God is offering us as a gift. And this psalm in the church is seen as so significant that it opens the divine office every day. There are alternatives you may use, but this is the standard invitatory psalm that invites us into the prayer of the church. The same warning holds. We are entering into God's presence when we enter into the Saudi, in reading the psalms. It's imperative that we listen to God's voice, or our offering of cult is empty and profitless. If I may go a longer introduction, I was reading something quite recently last week that I think is not unrelated to this warning before we actually read the psalm. The author was speaking of three 19th century authors that are most significant in our culture, and the challenge they posed to Christian religion. One was Karl Marx, who had a great passion for the poor and the underclass and justice. And when he looked at religion, now he didn't see it with full eyes, but when he looked at it, he saw a lot of religion had no regard for class distinctions, no regard for injustice. Didn't seem to care, was quite content to keep going while the poor were being, etc. And in his anger and in his brilliance, I suppose, in some ways, he thought of a system which then becomes communism, which of course didn't work and won't work because it misses out on some fundamentals. So we're not saying Karl Marx was right in his overall assessment, but he does remind us if religion's going to be real, Karl Marx didn't invent what he saw, he just didn't see the saints. He didn't see the wonderful work Jesus was done by so many people in the name of Jesus. But he did see what we often call institutionalized religion, which is a funny word and an unfair word, really. What he saw must have been there to see, do you know what I mean? So he must have seen a lot of religious cult going on without regard for real care of the poor. So he called religion the opium of the people. And it's not religion that was the opium of the people, it was something like greed or self-focus or a whole lot of other things that you might like to. But it's a bit like this. So going, praying, cult, religious worship, ceremonies. Karl Marx reminds us, if it's got nothing to do with justice, well, it's phony. Another person this one was referring to was Freud, who was dealing, as you know, with dysfunctional people, mentally dysfunctional. So he saw a skewed version of Christianity, of course. But what he saw was what he called infantile projectionism. These people, religion for them was just a crutch, and it wasn't really bringing them to maturity. It wasn't bringing them health. It wasn't healing. It wasn't actually, in a creative way, energizing people. It was keeping them locked in. Now, he didn't observe that for nothing. That was what he observed. Now, clearly, he didn't see the whole picture. That's not what religion is. But a lot of religion must look like that to a Freud, you know, to a psychiatrist. And therefore, he again reminds us that if our cult, if our religious practice, as this psalm will be going on to say, is not about growing up and not about becoming mature and not about facing the demons and working through the problems but using religion as a crutch, it's phony. It's not working. He again wasn't right in the way he summed up religion as being infantile projection. But I'm just reminding you that he wasn't blind and he wasn't a fool. So if there was a lot of religion in his day like that, is it not also true in our day? Could it not be? So it's a warning to us all. And the third person this author was speaking about was Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche, who looked at, now, what did he see? Again, we're looking at people who didn't get to the heart of Christianity, of course, but they saw things. And Nietzsche saw a church, a religious system, which he saw as largely against the world, putting the world down. The world was dark, and without this confidence in the world. Now, if only Nietzsche had been able to read Vatican II's Gaudium et Spes, he would have thought, wow. But then again, a lot of people who read Gaudium et Spes thought, wow, it was so beautiful. The world was a wonderful place to be loved into life, not a fearsome thing that we're to protect ourselves against. But what Nietzsche saw was real, partial, and his judgment of religion was wrong, in my view, and many people's view. But it's not unlike Psalm 95, which is saying, look, if you're doing all this praying, if you're saying all these things and doing all these things, but you're not listening to God, and of course a religious person, a John the 23rd, would have said to Nietzsche, look, Nietzsche, I understand what you're saying, but look, that's not what we're on about. You know, would have. And now in today's church, do we still have this problem? Are there any Nietzsches around who look at the church and think like this? Yes. Are they entirely wrong? No. So it's a matter of examining conscience and caring for the social body of Christ. What are we on about? Are we willing to live with injustice growing? And if I looked at the Australian church, I would say, yes, we are. We are a bit indifferent to this. We're not raging against it, put it that way. Is religion largely now an infantile projection, a kind of a comfort thing that's unreal for people who are not willing to grow up? And I'd have to say, look at myself and others, and I'd think, well, there's an element of that in it. And is religion a kind of a place we come to for protection against the darkness of the world? It shouldn't be. Well, because we're not here. We're here to love the world. We're here to. The gates of hell, says, you know, will not prevail against it. The church is supposed to be on the advance, not on the defence. That's my point. It's about taking the light of Christ into the world. Jesus wasn't afraid of the world. He loved it. And went into it and said to his apostles, go to the end of the world, you know. To love the people, love your enemies. It's the only way to put an end to all this ridiculous cycle of violence. So there's three modern people who I think Psalm 95 might bring it up to date for us. So let's look at the psalm. After that long introduction, an invitation. Come, let us acclaim Yahweh. Let us sing joyfully of the rock of our salvation. Let us come into his presence with thanksgiving. Let us sing joyfully to him to the sound of music. Great. Deuteronomy 26 might pick up some of that. When you've come into the land that Yahweh your God is giving you as an inheritance, you know that the book of Deuteronomy is all placed on the lips of Moses. It's like a last testament. It's got nothing to do with what anything Moses ever said or may, but we don't know that. But it's a much later document re-examining Judaism in the spirituality of the day prior to the collapse of Jerusalem. And it's placing all these words in a big stage of Moses, like getting to the heart of Judaism by placing all this literature on the lips of Moses. This is what Moses wanted us to be, you know, that kind of thing. Like a Jesuit, perhaps, writing a statement about this is what Ignatius expects of us today. So here, when you've come into the land that Yahweh your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall take some of the first of all the fruit of the ground. You shall put it in a basket and go to the place that Yahweh your God will choose as a dwelling for his name. The place that Yahweh your God will choose for, by the time Deuteronomy is finally composed, that means Jerusalem, of course. Yahweh, and say this, Yahweh brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and he brought us into this place, and he gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. So now I bring the first of the fruit of the ground that you, Yahweh, have given me. You shall set it down before Yahweh, Moses continues, and bow down before Yahweh your God. Then you, together with the Levites, and the aliens who reside among you shall celebrate with all the bounty that Yahweh your God has given to you and to your house. So with all these gifts, the first fruits, they come into the temple, and our psalm says, come in with thanksgiving, sing joyfully to him to the sound of music. For, he says, the psalm says, Yahweh is the high God, the sovereign over all the gods. Gods of Egypt and Babylon and Moab and so on. The high God, the sovereign of all the gods. We'll see these later, but I'll throw them in now. Just a little line from each of the following psalms. Psalm 96. Great is Yahweh, greatly to be praised, to be revered over all the gods. Psalm 97 we'll do this morning. All gods bow down before him. You can see we're still in a polytheistic world, clearly. And 1 Corinthians, Paul, the Jew, picks up some of this, inverted commas. He says, we know that, quote, no idol in the world really exists. And that seems to be a quote from the letter written to Paul, which he's responding to. So there's a letter come to him on the boat from Corinth over to Ephesus. He's writing back, and those people are saying, look, no God idol in the world really exists, so we can eat the meat that came from the temple in our homes. And some people are very scrupulous about that because they've been, all their life they've been told they can't eat this meat. It's idol worship. So some in the community are very tender, and you know they've been gone to school and they've learned all this, and they're really anxious about all this. And the others saying, "Oh, don't worry about that. There's no." They're quoting, see, there's no idol in the world, so it's all rubbish. Eat the meat, fine. And Paul's trying to. It's a wonderful text of sensitive pastoral leadership. Paul's doing. He's not denying that there are no gods. He's not denying that no idol really exists, but he's saying be sensitive to each other. And he said, well, if I was in a community where people thought that, he said, I wouldn't eat the meat. You don't have to prove yourself or stand on your rights. More important than that is to be sensitive to the broken people. But then he talks to the broken people too and says, look, but hang on, you've got to grow up a bit too. You know, so so back to Paul, 1 Corinthians 8. We know, it's true, that, brackets, quote, no idol in the world exists, and, again, quote, there's no God but one. We know that. Indeed, even though there are many, there may be so-called gods in heaven and earth, as in fact there are many gods and many lords in people's minds, yet for us there is only one God, the Father, from whom all things are and for whom we exist. And there's only one Lord, is Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. So let's look at Jesus, let him teach us about God, and what he'll teach you people who are insisting on eating this meat in front of your brothers and sisters who are real scrupulous about it, then what you're doing is you're hurting, he goes on to say, you're hurting someone for whom Christ died. So love is more important than anything else, so be careful of your love. Back to our psalm. Verse 4. In his hands are the depths of the earth, the heights of the mountains are his. His is the sea, for he made it, and the dry land which his hands have formed. Come, let us worship and bow low. Let us kneel before Yahweh, our Maker. So a beautiful invitation to cult, to worship. God as Maker is declared in many places, of course. I don't need to read them all to you, but I would like to just read this for your interest. Isaiah 44:2, which says, thus says Yahweh who made you, who formed you in the womb and will help you. Do not fear, O Jacob, my servant, Jeshurun, whom I have chosen. Jeshurun appears in Deuteronomy a couple of times, and here in Isaiah, I think that's probably the limit of it. There's probably about three or four times in the Bible, and scholars are not exactly sure what it means. One opinion, the one that I favour because it makes most sense to me, is that it's like a pet name you give someone. Like you've got a kid and her real name is Elizabeth, but you call her Libby, or I don't know what else you might do, you know, or just another name. It might be Mary, but you call her Molly, something like that. So Jeshurun seems to be a tender, a thick, because the Greek, the Septuagint, translates Jeshurun as ex agapetos. Anyhow, it's agapetos, the loved one, my loved one, agape, love. So they've obviously picked up that what I'm suggesting to you from the Jeshurun. So the one you've chosen, the one whom you formed in the womb, your Maker. Four, concluding first the first part of the psalm, he is our God. We are the people of his pasture, the sheep he feeds by hand. And then comes a break. The second part of the psalm. Suddenly, in the middle of all this invitation, comes, oh, that today you would listen to his voice. Today. Now. You people are, you know, you're good on tradition. You're good on canon law. You should be. You're good on all the councils of the church, including Vatican II, and you're good on the catechism, and you're good on all this. But what about today? Are you now listening to the voice of God as you pray this stuff? Are you listening to the prophets? Are you listening to the new word? It won't ever contradict tradition, but it's not enough to lock yourself into the past and just continue. God is alive. So, oh, that today you'd listen to his voice. What's God saying to you today, to us today? Psalm 81, similarly, oh, that my people would listen to me. Oh, that Israel would walk in my ways. And now the warning. Do not harden your hearts as at Meribah. On that day, as on that day at Massah in the wilderness. Meribah means strife. Massah means testing in Hebrew. So they've named the events that you'll find in the book of Exodus chapter 17, quite early on as they enter into the desert on their way to the Mount Sinai. They're named, like, symbolically, the place of strife, the place of testing. When your ancestors tested me and put me to the proof, though they'd seen my deeds, they'd seen me bring them out of Egypt, they'd seen the crossing of the Red Sea, but when they were thirsty, they didn't believe, and when Moses struck the rock, remember he had to he didn't really believe that God would give them water, and he didn't really believe that God would give them food, and then the quails came into the camp and all of that. Images for. For 40 years I was sickened by that generation. that first group of people that came out of Egypt, and I said, they are a people whose hearts are astray. They pay no regard to my ways. So in my anger I swore an oath, never shall they enter my rest. A dramatic end to this wonderful psalm. In other words, you can't take this for granted. You'll never enter the rest if you're going to not listen. And it's for us as well. The letter to the Hebrews, for those of you who might be interested in following it up, chapter 3, verse 7 to chapter 4, verse 11, quotes this psalm and develops this theme of the Christian community and not entering into the rest unless we listen to God's voice. On the subject of rest, just a few references that I'll leave you with for meditation. The first book of Kings, chapter 8, verse 56, has, "Blessed be Yahweh, who has given rest to his people Israel, according to all that he promised." This is the Shabbat, you know, the Sabbath day is a day of rest, where the people, the Jewish people, would stop all kinds of work. I mean, they got as bad as we can get. Any religious group can get very, like meticulous about all the details of what you can do and what you can't do, and it can become phony. But the principle was beautiful. On this day, no one was to work. And please remember, that meant not only the people who were rich, and you couldn't get your slaves to work. They had a day off. You couldn't get them working. You couldn't get your cattle working. You couldn't get anything working. No one was allowed to. So this was actually a pretty good social protection against the workers and the slaves in the home that had been conquered in battle, and they were kind of had no freedom. But at least on one day of the week, they could have their family life and be with their family and go around the maypole or whatever you do. But they could... They weren't able to be made to work. In fact, they weren't allowed to work, which is actually we've actually lost this, haven't we, in our world? Everything's open for 7 days a week, and everyone's just as busy, including myself, on a Sunday. Now, the Sunday isn't a day of rest; it's a day of mission. We don't have the Sabbath. We don't bring the Saturday into the Sunday, or we'll muck it up. We're not Jews, and we don't have a Sabbath day. We have a Sunday, which is the day of the resurrection, which is about mission, about outgoing love. It's quite a separate thing at all, even though in the law of the church, some of the Sabbath laws got dragged into the Sunday. That was like a lot of things happened in the history of the church. The Old Testament kept getting dragged back into the new, and we kept imagining God again with, you know, the freedom that Jesus gave us is pretty hard to hold. So we tended to trammel it up with the Old Testament legal systems, in spite of Paul telling us not to, and Jesus. Anyhow, back to Jeremiah 6:16. Thus says the Yahweh, stand at the crossroads and look. This is really nice. Ask for the ancient paths where your good way lies, and walk in it, and find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk in it. That's a beautiful text for the power of tradition. I'd love to be able to say to the 30-year-olds in our church, when they see their mum, you see this church here, frequently you see grandparents bringing their little children to Mass. And my heart bleeds, I have to tell you, because I think the parents are not enjoying this.
No.
And the kids aren't having their parents there with them. The grandparents are getting such joy, and the kids are getting such joy, and that group that's busy or whatever are just not enjoying the social gathering and listening to the word, and they don't know what they're missing. And they bring their kids here to confirmation last week. And then you look around the church at one Mass, there were two lovely boys. At another Mass, there were two lovely boys, because I was said that the two Masses I said, there were two in each, both boys, that had been confirmed. That's four. How many were the other Masses? I don't know. Probably a lot more, because I didn't do the 10 o'clock Mass, which is mainly a children's Mass. So all I'm just saying is, What does it mean for the children to be confirmed and the parents not to bring them to Mass next Sunday? What on earth does it mean? So it's tragic stuff. Where, see, ask for the ancient paths. And it's all happened in this generation too. It's a sudden break. We didn't have it in our generation. We all went to Mass because we didn't even think of not doing it. And I'm only 68, very young. So it's happened in the generation after that. And we've got hundreds of reasons, and we don't go into it now. And you can see, and a lot, there's no blame in any of this. I'm just saying it's a fact. So I think we'd only gain by asking for the ancient paths. And that doesn't mean Mass in Latin, because that's not actually that ancient. The Mass was said in Greek in Rome for the first 3 centuries. So these traditionalists who don't know their history need to be informed a bit. But at least let's the good way lies. Our grandparents are beautiful people for not for any bad reason. So let's learn. Walk in it and you'll find rest for your soul. But they say we won't walk in it. Jesus, clearly quoting, you can see the quote coming on. Take my yoke upon you, the double yoke that Jesus has. He's pulling with the yoke, but it's a double one. So he says, you come in next to me and take my yoke. I'll put my yoke, the yoke that I'm pulling, share it with me. Learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart, not like the yoke of the Pharisees that's burdening you all. And you'll find rest for your souls. There it is again. Same quote. Rest for your souls. Book of Revelation, chapter 14, verse 13. Write this. Blessed are the dead who from now on die in the Lord. Yes, says the Spirit, they will rest from their labours, for their deeds follow them.